Audio Renaissance presents Xenocide by Orson Scott Card.
1. A Parting.
Today, one of the brothers asked me, "Is it a terrible prison not to be able to move from the place where you're standing?"
You answered?
I told him that I am now more free than he is. The inability to move frees me from the obligation to act.
You who speak languages, you are such liars.
Han Feidza sat in lotus position on the bare wooden floor beside his wife's sickbed. Until a moment ago, he might have been sleeping. He wasn't sure. But now he was aware of the slight change in her breathing, a change as subtle as the wind from a butterfly's passing. Jiang Qing, for her part, must also have detected some change in him, for she had not spoken before, and now she did speak. Her voice was very soft, but Han Feidze could hear her clearly, for the house was silent. He had asked his friends and servants for stillness during the dusk of Jiang Qing's life. Time enough for careless noise during the long night that was to come, when there would be no hushed words from her lips. "Still not dead," she said. She had greeted him with these words each time she woke during the past few days. At first, the words had seemed whimsical or ironic to him, but now he knew that she spoke with disappointment. She longed for death now, not because she hadn't loved life, but because death was now unavoidable, and what cannot be shunned must be embraced. That was the path. Jiang Qing had never taken a step away from the path in her life.
"Then the gods are kind to me," said Han Feidze.
"To you," she breathed. "What do we contemplate?"
It was her way of asking him to share his private thoughts with her. When others asked his private thoughts, he felt spied upon. But Jiang Qing asked only so that she could also think the same thought. It was part of their having become a single soul.
"We are contemplating the nature of desire," said Han Feidze.
"Whose desire?" she asked.
"And for what?"
"My desire for your bones to heal and become strong, so that they don't snap at the slightest pressure, so that you could stand again, or even raise an arm without your own muscles tearing away chunks of bone or causing the bone to break under the tension, so that I wouldn't have to watch you wither away until now you weigh only 18 kilograms. I never knew how perfectly happy we were until I learned that we could not stay together."
"My desire," he answered, "for you."
"You only covet what you do not have. Who said that?"
"You did," said Han Feidze. "Some say what you cannot have. Others say what you should not have. I say you can truly covet only what you will always hunger for."
"You have me forever."
"I will lose you tonight, or tomorrow, or next week."
"Let us contemplate the nature of desire," said Jiang Qing.
As before, she was using philosophy to pull him out of his brooding melancholy. He resisted her, but only playfully.
"You are a harsh ruler," said Han Feidze. "Like your ancestor of the heart, you make no allowance for other people's frailty."
Jiang Qing was named for a revolutionary leader of the ancient past who had tried to lead the people onto a new path but was overthrown by weak-hearted cowards. It was not right, thought Han Feidze, for his wife to die before him. Her ancestor of the heart had outlived her husband. Besides, wives should live longer than husbands. Women were more complete inside themselves. They were also better at living in their children. They were never as solitary as a man alone. Jiang Qing refused to let him return to brooding.
"When a man's wife is dead, what does he long for?"
Rebelliously, Han Feidze gave her the most false answer to her question.
"To lie with her," he said.
"The desire of the body," said Jiang Qing.
Since she was determined to have this conversation, Hanfeza took up the catalogue for her. The desire of the body is to act. It includes all touches, casual and intimate, and all customary movements. Thus, he sees a movement out of the corner of his eye and thinks he has seen his dead wife moving across the doorway, and he cannot be content until he has walked to the door and seen that it was not his wife. Thus, he wakes up from a dream in which he heard her voice and finds himself speaking his answer aloud as if she could hear him.
"What else?" said Jiang Qing.
"I'm tired of philosophy," said Han Feizhe. "Maybe the Greeks found comfort in it, but not me."
"The desire of the spirit," said Jiang Qing, insisting.
"Because the spirit is of the earth, it is that part which makes new things out of old ones. The husband longs for all the unfinished things that he and his wife were making when she died, and all the unstarted dreams of what they would have made if she had lived. Thus a man grows angry at his children for being too much like him and not enough like his dead wife. Thus a man hates the house they lived in together, because either he does not change it so that it is as dead as his wife, or because he does change it so that it is no longer half of her making."
"You don't have to be angry at our little Jingzhao," said Jiang Qing.
"Why?" asked Han Feizhe. "Will you stay then, and help me teach her to be a woman? All I can teach her is to be what I am, cold and hard, sharp and strong, like obsidian. If she grows like that, while she looks so much like you, how can I help but be angry?"
"Because you can teach her everything that I am too," said Jiang Qing.
"If I had any part of you in me," said Han Feizhe, "I would not have needed to marry you to become a complete person." Now he teased her by using philosophy to turn the conversation away from pain. "That is the desire of the soul, because the soul is made of light and dwells in air. It is that part which conceives and keeps ideas, especially the idea of the self. The husband longs for his whole self, which was made of the husband and wife together. Thus he never believes any of his own thoughts, because there is always a question in his mind to which his wife's thoughts were the only possible answer. Thus the whole world seems dead to him, because he cannot trust anything to keep its meaning before the onslaught of this unanswerable question."
"Very deep," said Jiang Qing.
"If I were Japanese, I would commit seppuku, spilling my bowel into the jar of your ashes."
"Very wet and messy," she said.
He smiled. "Then I should be an ancient Hindu and burn myself on your pyre." But she was through with joking.
"Jingzhao," she whispered.
She was reminding him he could do nothing so flamboyant as to die with her. There was little Jingzhao to care for. So Han Feizhe answered her seriously. "How can I teach her to be what you are?"
"All that is good in me," said Jiang Qing, "comes from the path. If you teach her to obey the gods, honor the ancestors, love the people, and serve the rulers, I will be in her as much as you are."
"I would teach her the path as part of myself," said Han Feizhe.
"Not so," said Jiang Qing. "The path is not a natural part of you, my husband. Even with the gods speaking to you every day, you insist on believing in a world where everything can be explained by natural causes."
"I obey the gods." He thought bitterly that he had no choice, that even to delay obedience was torture.
"But you don't know them. You don't love their works."
"The path is to love the people. The gods we only obey. How can I love gods who humiliate me and torment me at every opportunity?"
"We love the people because they are creatures of the gods."
"Don't preach to me," she sighed. Her sadness stung him like a spider. "I wish you would preach to me forever."
said Han Feizhe.
You married me because you knew I loved the gods, and that love for them was completely missing from yourself. That was how I completed you.
How could he argue with her, when he knew that even now he hated the gods for everything they had ever done to him, everything they had ever made him do, everything they had stolen from him in his life?
Promise me, said Jiang Qing.
He knew what these words meant. She felt death upon her. She was laying the burden of her life upon him, a burden he would gladly bear. It was losing her company on the path that he had dreaded for so long.
Promise that you will teach Jing Zhao to love the gods and walk always on the path. Promise that you will make her as much my daughter as yours.
Even if she never hears the voice of the gods?
The path is for everyone, not just the god spoken.
Perhaps, thought Han Feizhe, but it was much easier for the god spoken to follow the path, because to them the price for straying from it was so terrible. The common people were free. They could leave the path and not feel the pain of it for years. The god spoken couldn't leave the path for an hour.
Promise me?
I will. I promise. But he couldn't say the words out loud. He did not know why, but his reluctance was deep. In the silence, as she waited for his vow, they heard the sound of running feet on the gravel outside the front door of the house. It could only be Jing Zhao, home from the garden of San Kao Pi. Only Jing Zhao was allowed to run and make noise during this time of hush. They waited, knowing that she would come straight to her mother's room. The door slid open almost noiselessly. Even Jing Zhao had caught enough of the hush to walk softly when she was actually in the presence of her mother. Though she walked on tiptoe, she could hardly keep from dancing, almost galloping across the floor. But she did not fling her arms around her mother's neck. She remembered that lesson, even though the terrible bruise had faded from Jiang Qing's face, where Qing Zhao's eager embrace had broken her jaw 3 months ago.
I counted 23 white carp in the garden stream, said Qing Zhao. So many, said Jiang Qing. I think they were showing themselves to me, said Qing Zhao, so I could count them. None of them wanted to be left out. Love you, whispered Jiang Qing.
Han Feizhe heard a new sound in her breathy voice, a popping sound like bubbles bursting with her words.
Do you think that seeing so many carp means that I will be God-spoken?
Asked Jing Zhao.
I will ask the gods to speak to you, said Jiang Qing.
Suddenly, Jiang Qing's breathing became quick and harsh. Han Feizhe immediately knelt and looked at his wife. Her eyes were wide and frightened. The moment had come. Her lips moved.
Promise me, she said,
though her breath could make no sound but gasping. I promise, said Han Feizhe. Then her breathing stopped.
What do the gods say when they talk to you? Asked Qing Zhao.
Your mother is very tired, said Han Feizhe. You should go out now.
But she didn't answer me. What do the gods say?
They tell secrets, said Han Feizhe. No one who hears will repeat them. Qing Zhao nodded wisely. She took a step back as if to leave, but stopped.
May I kiss you, Mama?
Lightly on the cheek, said Han Feizhe. Qing Zhao, being small for a four-year-old, did not have to bend very far at all to kiss her mother's cheek.
I love you, Mama.
You'd better leave now, Qing Zhao, said Han Feizhe.
But Mama didn't say she loved me too.
She did. She said it before, remember? But she's very tired and weak. Go now. He put just enough sternness in his voice that Jing Zhao left without further questions. Only when she was gone did Han Feizhe let himself feel anything but care for her. He knelt over Jiang Qing's body and tried to imagine what was happening to her now. Her soul had flown and was now already in heaven. Her spirit would linger much longer. Perhaps her spirit would dwell in this house, if it had truly been a place of happiness for her.
Superstitious people believed that all spirits of the dead were dangerous and put up signs and wards to fend them off. But those who followed the path knew that the spirit of a good person was never harmful or destructive, for their goodness in life had come from the spirit's love of making things. Jiang Qing's spirit would be a blessing in the house for many years to come if she chose to stay. Yet, even as he tried to imagine her soul and spirit according to the teachings of the path, there was a cold place in his heart that was certain that all that was left of Jiang Qing was this brittle, dried-up body. Tonight it would burn as quickly as paper, and then she would be gone, except for the memories in his heart. Jiang Qing was right. Without her to complete his soul, he was already doubting the gods. And the gods had noticed. They always did. At once he felt the unbearable pressure to do the ritual of cleansing, until he was rid of his unworthy thoughts. Even now they could not leave him unpunished. Even now, with his wife lying dead before him, the gods insisted that he do obeisance to them before he could shed a single tear of grief for her. At first he meant to delay, to put off obedience. He had schooled himself to be able to postpone the ritual for as long as a whole day, while hiding all outward signs of his inner torment. He could do that now, but only by keeping his heart utterly cold. There was no point in that. Proper grief could come only when he had satisfied the gods. So, kneeling there, he began the ritual. He was still twisting and gyrating with the ritual when a servant peered in. Though the servant said nothing, Han Feizi heard the faint sliding of the door and knew what the servant would assume. Jiang Qing was dead, and Han Feizi was so righteous that he was communing with the gods even before he announced her death to the household. No doubt, some would even suppose that the gods had come to take Jiang Qing, since she was known for her extraordinary holiness. No one would guess that even as Han Feizi worshipped, his heart was full of bitterness that the gods would dare demand this of him even now. "Oh, gods," he thought, "if I knew that by cutting off an arm, or cutting out my liver, I could be rid of you forever, I would seize the knife and relish the pain and loss, all for the sake of freedom." That thought, too, was unworthy, and required even more cleansing. It was hours before the gods at last released him, and by then he was too tired, too sick at heart to grieve. He got up and fetched the women to prepare Jiang Qing's body for the burning. At midnight, he was the last to come to the pyre, carrying a sleepy Qing Zhao in his arms. She clutched in her hands the three papers she had written for her mother in her childish scrawl. "Fish," she had written, and "book," and "secrets." These were the things that Qing Zhao was giving to her mother to carry with her into heaven. Han Feizi had tried to guess at the thoughts in Qing Zhao's mind as she wrote those words. "Fish, because of the carp in the garden stream today, no doubt. And book," that was easy enough to understand, because reading aloud was one of the last things Jiang Qing could do with her daughter. But why secrets? What secrets did Qing Zhao have for her mother? He could not ask. One did not discuss the paper offerings to the dead. Han Feizi set Qing Zhao on her feet. She had not been deeply asleep, and so she woke at once and stood there, blinking slowly. Han Feizi whispered to her, and she rolled her papers and tucked them into her mother's sleeve. She didn't seem to mind touching her mother's cold flesh. She was too young to have learned to shudder at the touch of death. Nor did Han Feizi mind the touch of his wife's flesh as he tucked his own three papers into her other sleeve. What was there to fear from death now, when it had already done its worst? No one knew what was written on his papers, or they would have been horrified, for he had written, "My body, my spirit, and my soul."
Thus it was that he burned himself on Jiang Qing's funeral pyre, and sent himself with her wherever it was she was going. Then Jiang Qing's secret maid, Mu Bao, laid the torch onto the sacred wood, and the pyre burst into flames. The heat of the fire was painful, and Qing Zhao hid herself behind her father, only peeking around him now and then to watch her mother leave on her endless journey.
Han Feizi, though, welcomed the dry heat that seared his skin and made brittle the silk of his robe. Her body had not been as dry as it seemed. Long after the papers had crisped into ash and blown upward into the smoke of the fire, her body still sizzled, and the heavy incense burning all around the fire could not conceal from him the smell of burning flesh. That is what we're burning here. Meat, fish, carrion, nothing. Not my Jiang Qing. Only the costume she wore into this life, that which made that body into the woman that I loved, is still alive, must still live. And for a moment he thought he could see, or hear, or somehow feel the passage of Jiang Qing. Into the air, into the earth, into the fire. I am with you.
2. A meeting.
The strangest thing about humans is the way they pair up, males and females, constantly at war with each other, never content to leave each other alone. They never seem to grasp the idea that males and females are separate species, with completely different needs and desires, forced to come together only to reproduce.
Of course you feel that way. Your mates are nothing but mindless drones, extensions of yourself, without their own identity.
We know our lovers with perfect understanding. Humans invent an imaginary lover, and put that mask over the face of the body in their bed.
That is the tragedy of language, my friend. Those who know each other only through symbolic representations are forced to imagine each other, and because their imagination is imperfect, they are often wrong.
That is the source of their misery.
And some of their strength, I think. Your people and mine, each for our own evolutionary reasons, mate with vastly unequal partners. Our mates are always, hopelessly, our intellectual inferiors. Humans mate with beings who challenge their supremacy. They have conflict between mates, not because their communication is inferior to ours, but because they commune with each other at all.
Valentine Wigan read over her essay, making a few corrections here and there. When she was done, the words stood in the air over her computer terminal. She was feeling pleased with herself for having written such a deft, ironic dismemberment of the personal character of Rymus Ojman, the chairman of the cabinet of Starway's Congress. "Have we finished another attack on the masters of the Hundred Worlds?" Valentine did not turn to face her husband. She knew from his voice exactly what expression would be on his face, and so she smiled back at him without turning around. After 25 years of marriage, they could see each other clearly without having to look. "We have made Rymus Ojman look ridiculous." Yacht leaned into her tiny office, his face so close to hers that she could hear his soft breathing as he read the opening paragraphs. He wasn't young anymore. The exertion of leaning into her office, bracing his hands on the doorframe, was making him breathe more rapidly than she liked to hear. Then he spoke, but with his face so close to hers that she felt his lips brush her cheek, tickling her with every word. "From now on, even his mother will laugh behind her hand whenever she sees the poor bastard." "It was hard to make it funny," said Valentine. "I caught myself denouncing him again and again. This is better." "Oh, I know. If I had let my outrage show, if I had accused him of all his crimes, it would have made him seem more formidable and frightening, and the rule of law faction would have loved him all the more, while the cowards on every world would have bowed to him even lower." "If they bow any lower, they'll have to buy thinner carpets," said Yacht. She laughed, but it was as much because the tickling of his lips on her cheek was becoming unbearable. It was also beginning, just a little, to tantalize her with desires that simply could not be satisfied on this voyage. The starship was too small and cramped, with all their family aboard, for any real privacy. Yacht, we're almost at the midpoint. We've abstained longer than this during the mishmish run every year of our lives. We could put a do not enter sign on the door. Then you might just as well put out a sign that says, naked elderly couple reliving old memories inside. I'm not elderly. You're over 60. If the old soldier can still stand up and salute, I say let him march in the parade. No parades till the voyage is over. It's only a couple of weeks more. We only have to complete this rendezvous with Ender's stepson, and then we're back on course to Lusitania. Yacht drew away from her, pulled himself out of her doorway, and stood upright in the corridor, one of the few places on the starship where he could actually do that. He groaned as he did it, though. You creak like an old rusty door, said Valentine. I've heard you make the same sounds when you get up from your desk here. I'm not the only senile, decrepit, miserable old coot in our family. Go away and let me transmit this. I'm used to having work to do on a voyage, said Yacht. The computers do everything here, and the ship never rolls or pitches in the sea. Read a book. I worry about you. All work and no play makes Val a mean-tempered old hag. Every minute that we talk here is 8.5 hours in real time. Our time here on this starship is just as real as their time out there, said Yacht. Sometimes I wish Ender's friends hadn't figured out a way for our starship to keep up a landside link. It takes up a huge amount of computer time, said Val. Until now, only the military could communicate with starships during near-light-speed flight. If Ender's friends can achieve it, then I owe it to them to use it. You're not doing all this because you owe it to somebody. That was true enough. If I write an essay every hour, Yacht, it means that to the rest of humanity, Demosthenes is publishing something only once every 3 weeks. You can't possibly write an essay every hour. You sleep, you eat. You talk, I listen. Go away, Yacht. If I'd known that saving a planet from destruction would mean my returning to a state of virginity, I'd never have agreed to it. He was only half teasing. Leaving Trondheim was a hard decision for all her family, even for her, even knowing that she was going to see Ender again. The children were all adults now, or nearly so. They saw this voyage as a great adventure. Their visions of the future were not so tied to a particular place. None of them had become a sailor like their father. All of them were becoming scholars or scientists, living the life of public discourse and private contemplation like their mother. They could live their lives, substantially unchanged, anywhere, on any world. Yacht was proud of them, but disappointed that the chain of family reaching back for 7 generations on the seas of Trondheim would end with him. And now, for her sake, he had given up the sea himself. Giving up Trondheim was the hardest thing she could ever have asked of Yacht, and he had said yes without hesitation. Perhaps he would go back someday, and if he did, the oceans, the ice, the storms, the fish, the desperately sweet green meadows of summer would still be there. But his crews would be gone, were already gone. The men he had known better than his own children, better than his wife, those men were already 15 years older, and when he returned, if he returned, another 40 years would have passed. Their grandsons would be working the boats then. They wouldn't know the name of Yacht. He'd be a foreign shipowner come from the sky, not a sailor, not a man with the stink and yellowy blood of Skrika on his hands. He would not be one of them. So when he complained that she was ignoring him, when he teased about their lack of intimacy during the voyage, there was more to it than an aging husband's playful desire. Whether he knew he was saying it or not, she understood the true meaning of his overtures. After what I've given up for you, have you nothing to give to me? And he was right. She was pushing herself harder than she needed to. She was making more sacrifices than needed to be made, requiring overmuch from him as well. It wasn't the sheer number of subversive essays that Demosthenes published during this voyage that would make the difference. What mattered was how many people read and believed what she wrote, and how many then thought and spoke and acted as enemies of Starway's Congress. Perhaps more important was the hope that some within the bureaucracy of Congress itself would be moved to feel a higher allegiance to humanity and break their maddening institutional solidarity. Some would surely be changed by what she wrote. Not many, but maybe enough. And maybe it would happen in time to stop them from destroying the planet Lusitania. If not, she and Yacht and those who had given up so much to come with them on this voyage from Trondheim would reach Lusitania just in time to turn around and flee, or be destroyed along with all the others of that world. It was not unreasonable for Yacht to be tense, to want to spend more time with her. It was unreasonable for her to be so single-minded, to use every waking moment writing propaganda. "You make the sign for the door, and I'll make sure you aren't alone in the room. Woman, you make my heart go flip-flop like a dying flounder," said Yacht. "You are so romantic when you talk like a fisherman," said Valentine. "The children will have a good laugh, knowing you couldn't keep your hands off me even for the 3 weeks of this voyage. They have our genes. They should be rooting for us to stay randy till we're well into our second century.
I'm well into my fourth millennium."
"When, oh when, can I expect you in my stateroom, ancient one?"
"When I've transmitted this essay."
"And how long will that be?"
"Sometime after you go away and leave me alone." With a deep sigh that was more theater than genuine misery, he padded off down the carpeted corridor. After a moment there came a clanging sound, and she heard him yelp in pain. In mock pain, of course. He had accidentally hit the metal beam with his head on the first day of the voyage, but ever since then his collisions had been deliberate, for comic effect. No one ever laughed out loud, of course. That was a family tradition, not to laugh when Yacht pulled one of his physical gags. But then Yacht was not the sort of man who needed overt encouragement from others. He was his own best audience. A man couldn't be a sailor and a leader of men all his life without being quite self-contained. As far as Valentine knew, she and the children were the only people he had ever allowed himself to need. Even then, he had not needed them so much that he couldn't go on with his life as a sailor and fisherman, away from home for days, often weeks, sometimes months at a time. Valentine went with him sometimes at first, when they were still so hungry for each other that they could never be satisfied. But within a few years their hunger had given way to patience and trust. When he was away, she did her research and wrote her books, and then gave her entire attention to him and the children when he returned. The children used to complain, "I wish Father would get home so Mother would come out of her room and talk to us again." "I was not a very good mother," Valentine thought. "It's pure luck that the children turned out so well." The essay remained in the air over the terminal. Only a final touch remained to be given. At the bottom, she centered the cursor and typed the name under which all her writings were published. Demosthenes. It was a name given to her by her older brother Peter when they were children together 3,000 years ago. The mere thought of Peter still had the power to upset her, to make her go hot and cold inside. Peter, the cruel one, the violent one, the one whose mind was so subtle and dangerous that he was manipulating her by the age of 2 and the world by the age of 20. When they were still children on Earth in the 22nd century, he studied the political writings of great men and women, living and dead, not to learn their ideas, those he grasped instantly, but to learn how they said them, to learn, in practical terms, how to sound like an adult. When he had mastered it, he taught Valentine and forced her to write low political demagoguery under the name of Demosthenes, while he wrote elevated statesmanlike essays under the name Locke. Then they submitted them to the computer networks and within a few years were at the heart of the greatest political issues of the day. What galled Valentine then, and still stung a bit today, since it had never been resolved before Peter died, was that he, consumed by the lust for power, had forced her to write the sort of thing that expressed his character, while he got to write the peace-loving, elevated sentiments that were hers by nature. In those days, the name Demosthenes had felt like a terrible burden to her. Everything she wrote under that name was a lie, and not even her lie, Peter's lie. A lie within a lie. Not now. Not for 3,000 years. I've made the name my own. I've written histories and biographies that have shaped the thinking of millions of scholars on the 100 worlds and helped to shape the identities of dozens of nations. So much for you, Peter. So much for what you tried to make of me. Except that now, looking at the essay she had just written, she realized that even though she had freed herself from Peter's suzerainty, she was still his pupil. All she knew of rhetoric, polemic, yes, of demagoguery, she had learned from him, or because of his insistence. And now, though she was using it in a noble cause, she was nevertheless doing exactly the sort of political manipulation that Peter had loved so much. Peter had gone on to become hegemon, ruler of all humanity for 60 years at the beginning of the Great Expansion. He was the one who united all the quarreling communities of man for the vast effort that flung starships out to every world where the buggers had once dwelt, and then on to discover more habitable worlds until, by the time he died, all the 100 worlds had either been settled or had colony ships on the way. It was almost 1,000 years after that, of course, before Starway's Congress once again united all of humankind under one government. But the memory of the first true hegemon, the hegemon, was at the heart of the story that made human unity possible. Out of a moral wasteland like Peter's soul came harmony and unity and peace. While Ender's legacy, as far as humanity remembered, was murder, slaughter, xenocide. Ender, Valentine's younger brother, the man she and her family were voyaging to see, he was the tender one, the brother she loved and, in the earliest years, tried to protect. He was the good one. Oh, yes, he had a streak of ruthlessness that rivaled Peter's, but he had the decency to be appalled by his own brutality. She had loved him as fervently as she had loathed Peter, and when Peter exiled his younger brother from the earth that Peter was determined to rule, Valentine went with Ender, her final repudiation of Peter's personal hegemony over her. "And here I am again," thought Valentine, "back in the business of politics." She spoke sharply in a clipped voice that told her terminal that she was giving it a command. "Transmit," she said. The word "transmitting" appeared in the air above her essay. Ordinarily, back when she was writing scholarly works, she would have had to specify a destination, submit the essay to a publisher through some roundabout pathway so that it could not readily be traced to Valentine Wigan. Now, though, a subversive friend of Ender's, working under the obvious code name of Jane, was taking care of all that for her. Managing the tricky business of translating an Ansible message from a ship going at near light speed to a message readable by a planet-bound Ansible for which time was passing more than 500 times faster. Since communicating with a starship ate up huge amounts of planet-side Ansible time, it was usually done only to convey navigational information and instructions. The only people permitted to send extended text messages were high officials in the government or the military. Valentine could not begin to understand how Jane managed to get so much Ansible time for these text transmissions, and at the same time keep anyone from discovering where these subversive documents were coming from. Furthermore, Jane used even more Ansible time transmitting back to her the published responses to her writings, reporting to her on all the arguments and strategies the government was using to counter Valentine's propaganda. Whoever Jane was, and Valentine suspected that Jane was simply the name for a clandestine organization that had penetrated the highest reaches of government, she was extraordinarily good and extraordinarily foolhardy. Still, if Jane was willing to expose herself, themselves, to such risks, Valentine owed it to her, them, to produce as many tracts as she could, and as powerful and dangerous as she could make them. If words can be lethal weapons, I must provide them with an arsenal. But she was still a woman. Even revolutionaries are allowed to have a life, aren't they? Moments of joy, or pleasure, or perhaps only relief, stolen here and there. She got up from her seat, ignoring the pain that came from moving after sitting so long, and twisted her way out of the door of her tiny office, a storage bin, really, before they converted the starship to their own use. She was a little ashamed of how eager she was to get to the room where Yacht would be waiting. Most of the great revolutionary propagandists in history would have been able to endure at least 3 weeks of physical abstinence. Or would they? She wondered if anyone had done a study of that particular question. She was still imagining how a researcher would go about writing a grant proposal for such a project when she got to the 4-bunk compartment they shared with Sifta and her husband, Lars, who had proposed to her only a few days before they left, as soon as he realized that Sifta really meant to leave Trondheim. It was hard to share a cabin with newlyweds. Valentine always felt like such an intruder using the same room, but there was no choice. Though this starship was a luxury yacht with all the amenities they could hope for, it simply hadn't been meant to hold so many bodies. It had been the only starship near Trondheim that was remotely suitable, so it had to do. Their 20-year-old daughter, Ro, and Varsim, their 16-year-old son, shared another compartment with Plicht, who had been their lifelong tutor and dearest family friend. The members of the yacht staff and crew who had chosen to make this voyage with them, it would have been wrong to dismiss them all and strand them on Trondheim, used the other two. The bridge, the dining room, the galley, the salon, the sleeping compartments, all were filled with people doing their best not to let their annoyance at the close quarters get out of hand. None of them were in the corridor now, however, and Yacht had already taped a sign to their door, "Stay out or die." It was signed, "The Proprietor." Valentine opened the door. Yacht was leaning against the wall so close to the door that she was startled and gave a little gasp.
"Well, it's nice to know that the sight of me can make you cry out in pleasure." "In shock." "Come in, my sweet seditionist."
"Technically, you know, I'm the proprietor of the starship."
"What's yours is mine. I married you for your property."
She was inside the compartment now. He closed the door and sealed it. "That's all I am to you?" she asked. "Real estate?"
"A little plot of ground where I can plow and plant and harvest, all in their proper season."
He reached out to her. She stepped into his arms. His hand slid lightly up her back, cradled her shoulders. She felt contained in his embrace, never confined. "It's late in the autumn," she said, "getting on toward winter."
"Time to harrow, perhaps," said Yacht.
"Or perhaps it's already time to kindle up the fire and keep the old hut warm before the snow comes."
He kissed her, and it felt like the first time. "If you asked me to marry you all over again today, I'd say yes," said Valentine.
"And if I'd only met you for the first time today, I'd ask."
They had said the same words many, many times before, yet they still smiled to hear them, because they were still true.
The two starships had almost completed their vast ballet, dancing through space in great leaps and delicate turns, until at last they could meet and touch. Miro Hibera had watched the whole process from the bridge of his starship, his shoulders hunched, his head leaned back on the headrest of the seat. To others, this posture always looked awkward. Back on Lusitania, whenever Mother caught him sitting that way, she would come and fuss over him, insist on bringing him a pillow so he could be comfortable. She never seemed to grasp the idea that it was only in that hunched, awkward-seeming posture that his head would remain upright without any conscious effort on his part. He would endure her ministrations because it wasn't worth the effort to argue with her. Mother was always moving and thinking so quickly, it was almost impossible for her to slow down enough to listen to him. Since the brain damage he had suffered passing through the disruptor field that separated the human colony and the piggy's forest, his speech had been unbearably slow, painful to produce, and difficult to understand. Miro's brother, King, the religious one, had told him that he should be grateful to God that he was able to speak at all. The first few days he had been incapable of communicating except through alphabetic scanning, spelling out messages letter by letter. In some ways, though, spelling things out had been better. At least then, Miro had been silent. He hadn't had to listen to his own voice. The thick, awkward sound, the agonizing slowness of it. Who in his family had the patience to listen to him? Even the ones who tried, his next younger sister, Ella, his friend and stepfather, Andrew Wiggin, the speaker for the dead, and King, of course. He could feel their impatience. They tended to finish his sentences for him. They needed to hurry things. So even though they said they wanted to talk with him, even though they actually sat and listened as he spoke, he still couldn't speak freely to them. He couldn't talk about ideas. He couldn't speak in long, involved sentences, because by the time he got to the end, his listeners would have lost track of the beginning. The human brain, Miro had concluded, just like a computer, can only receive data at certain speeds. If you get too slow, the listener's attention wanders and the information is lost. Not just the listeners, either. Miro had to be fair. He was as impatient with himself as they were. When he thought of the sheer effort involved in explaining a complicated idea, when he anticipated trying to form the words with lips and tongue and jaws that wouldn't obey him, when he thought of how long it would all take, he usually felt too weary to speak. His mind raced on and on, as fast as ever, thinking so many thoughts that at times Miro wanted his brain to shut down, to be silent and give him peace. But his thoughts remained his own, unshared. Except with Jane. He could speak to Jane. She had come to him first on his terminal at home, her face taking form on the screen. "I'm a friend of the Speaker for the Dead," she had told him. "I think we can get this computer to be a little more responsive." From then on, Miro had found that Jane was the only person he could talk to easily. For one thing, she was infinitely patient. She never finished his sentences. She could wait for him to finish them himself, so that he never felt rushed, never felt that he was boring her. Perhaps even more important, he didn't have to form his words as fully for her as he did for his human listeners. Andrew had given him a personal terminal, a computer transceiver encased in a jewel like the one Andrew wore in his own ear. From that vantage point, using the jewel's sensors, Jane could detect every sound he made, every motion of the muscles in his head. He didn't have to complete each sound. He had only to begin it, and she would understand. So he could be lazy. He could speak more quickly and be understood. And he could also speak silently. He could sub-vocalize. He didn't have to use that awkward, barking, yowling voice that was all his throat could produce now. So that when he was talking to Jane, he could speak quickly, naturally, without any reminder that he was crippled. With Jane, he could feel like himself. Now he sat on the bridge of the cargo ship that had brought the Speaker for the Dead to Lusitania only a few months ago. He dreaded the rendezvous with Valentine's ship. If he could have thought of somewhere else to go, he might have gone there. He had no desire to meet Andrew's sister Valentine or anybody else. If he could have stayed alone in the starship forever, speaking only to Jane, he would have been content. No, he wouldn't. He would never be content again. At least this Valentine and her family would be somebody new. On Lusitania, he knew everybody, or at least everybody that he valued, all the scientific community there, the people of education and understanding. He knew them all so well that he could not help but see their pity, their grief, their frustration at what had become of him. When they looked at him, all they could see was the difference between what he was before and what he was now. All they could see was loss. There was a chance that new people, Valentine and her family, would be able to look at him and see something else. Even that was unlikely, though. Strangers would look at him and see less, not more, than those who had known him before he was crippled. At least Mother and Andrew and Ella and Wanda and all the others knew that he had a mind, knew that he was capable of understanding ideas. What will new people think when they see me? They'll see a body that's already atrophying, hunched over. They'll see me walk with a shuffling gait. They'll watch me use my hands like paws, clutching a spoon like a 3-year-old. They'll hear my thick, half-intelligible speech, and they'll assume, they'll know, that such a person cannot possibly understand anything complicated or difficult. Why did I come? I didn't come. I went. I wasn't coming here to meet these people. I was leaving there, getting away. Only I tricked myself. I thought of leaving on a 30-year voyage, which is only how it will seem to them. To me, I've been gone only a week and a half. No time at all. And already my time of solitude is over. My time of being alone with Jane, who listens to me as if I were still a human being, is done. Almost. Almost he said the words that would have aborted the rendezvous. He could have stolen Andrew's starship and taken off on a voyage that would last forever without having to face another living soul. But such a nihilistic act was not in him, not yet. He had not yet despaired, he decided. There might yet be something he could do that might justify his continuing to live in this body. And perhaps it would begin with meeting Andrew's sister. The ships were now joining, the umbilicals snaking outward and searching, groping till they met each other. Miro watched on the monitors and listened to the computer reports of each successful linkage. The ships were joining in every possible way so that they could make the rest of the voyage to Lusitania in perfect tandem. All resources would be shared. Since Miro's ship was a cargo vessel, it couldn't take on more than a handful of people, but it could take some of the other ship's life support supplies. Together, the two ships' computers were figuring out a perfect balance. Once they had calculated the load, they worked out exactly how fast each ship should accelerate as they made the park shift to get them both back to near light speed at exactly the same pace. It was an extremely delicate and complicated negotiation between two computers that had to know almost perfectly what their ships carried and how they could perform. It was finished before the passage tube between the ships was fully connected. Miro heard the footsteps scuffing along the corridor from the tube. He turned his chair, slowly, because he did everything slowly, and saw her coming toward him. Stooped over, but not very much, because she wasn't that tall to begin with. Hair mostly white, with a few strands of mousy brown. When she stood, he looked at her face and judged her. Old, but not elderly. If she was nervous about this meeting, it didn't show. But then from what Andrew and Jane had told him about her, she had met a lot of people who were a good deal more fearsome than a 20-year-old cripple.
Miro? She asked.
Who else? He said. It took a moment, just a heartbeat, for her to process the strange sounds that came out of his mouth and recognize the words. He was used to that pause now, but he still hated it.
I'm Valentine, she said.
I know, he answered. He wasn't making this any easier with his laconic replies, but what else was there to say? This wasn't exactly a meeting between heads of state with a list of vital decisions to make. But he had to make some effort, if only not to seem hostile.
Your name, Miro, it means I look, doesn't it?
I look closely. Maybe I pay attention.
It's really not that hard to understand you, said Valentine.
He was startled that she addressed the matter so openly.
I think I'm having more problems with your Portuguese accent than with the brain damage.
For a moment it felt like a hammer in his heart. She was speaking more frankly about his situation than anyone except Andrew. But then she was Andrew's sister, wasn't she? He should have expected her to be plain-spoken. Or do you prefer that we pretend that it isn't a barrier between you and other people? Apparently she had sensed his shock. But that was over, and now it occurred to him that he probably shouldn't be annoyed, that he should probably be glad that they wouldn't have to sidestep the issue. Yet he was annoyed, and it took him a moment to think why. Then he knew.
My brain damage isn't your problem, he said.
If it makes it hard for me to understand you, then it's a problem I have to deal with. Don't get prickly with me already, young man. I have only begun to bother you, and you have only begun to bother me. So don't get steamed up because I happened to mention your brain damage as being somehow my problem. I have no intention of watching every word I say for fear I'll offend an oversensitive young man who thinks the whole world revolves around his disappointments.
Miro was furious that she had judged him already, and so harshly. It was unfair, not at all what the author of Demosthenes' Hierarchy ought to be like.
I don't think the whole world revolves around my disappointments, But don't you think you can come in here and run things on my ship?
That's what annoyed him, not her words. She was right, her words were nothing. It was her attitude, her complete self-confidence. He wasn't used to people looking at him without shock or pity. She sat down in the seat next to him. He swiveled to face her. She, for her part, did not look away. Indeed, she pointedly scanned his body, head to toe, looking him over with an air of cool appraisal. He said you were tough. He said you had been twisted, but not broken.
Are you supposed to be my therapist?
Are you supposed to be my enemy?
Should I be? Asked Miro.
No more than I should be your therapist. Andrew didn't have us meet so I could heal you. He had us meet so you could help me. If you're not going to, fine. If you are, fine. Just let me make a few things clear. I'm spending every waking moment writing subversive propaganda to try to arouse public sentiment on the 100 worlds and in the colonies. I'm trying to turn the people against the fleet that Starways Congress has sent to subdue Lusitania. Your world, not mine, I might add.
Your brother's there.
He was not about to let her claim complete altruism. Yes, we both have family there, and we both are concerned about keeping the Pequeninos from destruction. And we both know that Ender has restored the Hive Queen on your world, so that there are two alien species that will be destroyed if Starways Congress gets its way. There's a great deal at stake, and I am already doing all that I can possibly do to try to stop that fleet. Now, if spending a few hours with you can help me do it better, it's worth taking time away from my writing in order to talk with you. But I have no intention of wasting my time worrying about whether I'm going to offend you or not. So, if you're going to be my adversary, you can sit up here all by yourself, and I'll get back to my work.
Andrew said you were the best person he ever knew.
He reached that conclusion before he saw me raise 3 barbarian children to adulthood. I understand your mother has 6.
Right.
And you're the oldest?
Yes.
That's too bad. Parents always make their worst mistakes with the oldest children. That's when parents know the least and care the most, so they're more likely to be wrong and also more likely to insist that they're right. Miro didn't like hearing this woman leap to conclusions about his mother.
She's nothing like you.
Of course not. She leaned forward in her seat. Well, have you decided?
Decided what?
Are we working together, or did you just unplug yourself from 30 years of human history for nothing?
What do you want from me?
Stories, of course. Facts I can get from the computer.
Stories about what?
You, the piggies. You and the piggies. This whole business with the Lusitania fleet began with you and the piggies, after all. It was because you interfered with them that...
We helped them.
Oh, did I use the wrong word again? Miro glared at her. But even as he did, he knew that she was right. He was being oversensitive. The word interfered, when used in a scientific context, was almost value neutral. It merely meant that he had introduced change into the culture he was studying. And if it did have a negative connotation, it was that he had lost his scientific perspective. He had stopped studying the Pequeninos and started treating them as friends. Of that, he was surely guilty. No, not guilty. He was proud of having made that transition.
Go on, he said.
All this began because you broke the law and piggies started growing amaranth.
Not anymore.
Yes, that's ironic, isn't it? The Descolada virus has gotten in and killed every strain of amaranth that your sister developed for them. So your interference was in vain.
No, it wasn't, said Miro. They're learning.
Yes, I know. More to the point, they're choosing what to learn, what to do. You brought them freedom. I approve wholeheartedly of what you decided to do. But my job is to write about you to the people out there in the 100 worlds and the colonies, and they won't necessarily see things that way. So what I need from you is the story of how and why you broke the law and interfered with the piggies, and why the government and people of Lusitania rebelled against Congress rather than send you off to be tried and punished for your crimes.
Andrew already told you that story.
And I've already written about it in larger terms. Now I need the personal things. I want to be able to let other people know these so-called piggies as people. And you too. I have to let them know you as a person. If it's possible, it would be nice if I could bring them to like you. Then the Lusitania fleet will look like what it is, a monstrous overreaction to a threat that never existed.
The fleet is Xenocide.
So I've said in my propaganda, said Valentine. He couldn't bear her self-certainty. He couldn't bear her unshakable faith in herself. So he had to contradict her, and the only way he could was to blurt out ideas that he had not yet thought out completely, ideas that were still only half-formed doubts in his mind.
The fleet is also self-defense.
It had the desired effect. It stopped her lecture and even made her raise her eyebrows, questioning him. The trouble was, now he had to explain what he meant.
The Descolada, he said. It's the most dangerous form of life anywhere.
The answer to that is quarantine. Not sending a fleet armed with the MD device, so they have the capacity to turn Lusitania and everybody on it into microscopic interstellar dust.
You're so sure you're right?
I'm sure that it's wrong for Starways Congress even to contemplate obliterating another sentient species.
The piggies can't live without the Descolada, said Miro. And if the Descolada ever spreads to another planet, it will destroy all life there. It will.
It was a pleasure to see that Valentine was capable of looking puzzled. But I thought the virus was contained. It was your grandparents who found a way to stop it, to make it dormant in human beings.
The Descolada adapts, said Miro. Jane told me that it's already changed itself a couple of times. My mother and my sister Ella are working on it, trying to stay ahead of the Descolada. Sometimes it even looks like the Descolada is doing it deliberately, intelligently, finding strategies to get around the chemicals we use to contain it and stop it from killing people. It's getting into the earth-born crops that humans need in order to survive on Lusitania. They have to spray them now. What if the Descolada finds a way to get around all our barriers?
Valentine was silent. No glib answer now. She hadn't faced this question squarely. No one had, except Miro.
I haven't even told this to Jane, said Miro. But what if the fleet is right? What if the only way to save humanity from the Descolada is to destroy Lusitania now?
No, said Valentine. This has nothing to do with the purposes for which Starways Congress sent out the fleet. Their reasons all have to do with interplanetary politics, with showing the colonies who's boss. It has to do with a bureaucracy out of control and a military that...
Listen to me, said Miro. You said you wanted to hear my stories. Listen to this one. It doesn't matter what their reasons are. It doesn't matter if they're a bunch of murderous beasts. I don't care. What matters is, should they blow up Lusitania?
What kind of person are you? Asked Valentine. He could hear both awe and loathing in her voice.
You're the moral philosopher, said Miro. You tell me. Are we supposed to love the Pequeninos so much that we allow the virus they carry to destroy all of humanity?
Of course not. We simply have to find a way to neutralize the Descolada.
And if we can't?
Then we quarantine Lusitania, even if all the human beings on the planet die. Your family and mine, we still don't destroy the Pequeninos.
Really?
Asked Miro.
What about the Hive Queen?
Ender told me that she was reestablishing herself, but...
She contains within herself a complete industrialized society. She's going to build starships and get off the planet.
She wouldn't take the Descolada with her.
She has no choice. The Descolada is in her already. It's in me.
That was when he really got to her. He could see it in her eyes, the fear.
It'll be in you, too. Even if you run back to your ship and seal me off and keep yourself from infection, once you land on Lusitania, the Descolada will get into you and your husband and your children. They'll have to ingest the chemicals with their food and water every day of their lives. And they can never go away from Lusitania again, or they'll carry death and destruction with them.
I suppose we knew that was a possibility, said Valentine.
When you left, it was only a possibility. We thought that the Descolada would soon be controlled. Now they aren't sure if it can ever be controlled. And that means that you can never leave Lusitania once you go there.
I hope we like the weather. Miro studied her face, the way she was processing the information he had given her. The initial fear was gone. She was herself again, thinking.
Here's what I think, said Miro. I think that no matter how terrible Congress is, no matter how evil their plans might be, that fleet might be the salvation of humanity.
Valentine answered thoughtfully, searching for words. Miro was glad to see that. She was a person who didn't shoot back without thinking. She was able to learn. I can see that if events move down one possible path, there might be a time when... But it's very improbable. First of all, knowing all this, the Hive Queen is quite unlikely to build any starships that would carry the Descolada away from Lusitania.
Do you know the Hive Queen? Demanded Miro. Do you understand her?
Even if she would do such a thing. Your mother and sister are working on this, aren't they? By the time we reach Lusitania, by the time the fleet reaches Lusitania, they might have found a way to control the Descolada once and for all.
And if they do, should they use it?
Why shouldn't they?
How could they kill all the Descolada virus? The virus is an integral part of the Pequenino life cycle. When the Pequenino body form dies, it's the Descolada virus that enables the transformation into the tree state, what the piggies call the third life. And it's only in the third life, as trees, that the Pequenino males can fertilize the females. If the virus is gone, there can be no more passage into the third life, and this generation of piggies is the last.
That doesn't make it impossible, it only makes it harder. Your mother and sister have to find a way to neutralize the Descolada in human beings and the crops we need to eat without destroying its ability to enable the Pequeninos to pass into adulthood.
And they have less than 15 years to do it, said Miro. Not likely.
But not impossible.
Yes, there's a chance. And on the strength of that chance, you want to get rid of the fleet.
The fleet is being sent to destroy Lusitania whether we control the Descolada virus or not.
And I say it again, the motive of the senders is irrelevant. No matter what the reason, the destruction of Lusitania may be the only sure protection for all the rest of humanity.
And I say you're wrong.
You're Demosthenes, aren't you? Andrew said you were.
Yes.
So you thought up the hierarchy of foreignness. Utlannings are strangers from our own world. Framlings are strangers of our own species, but from another world. Ramen are strangers of another species, but capable of communication with us, capable of coexistence with humanity. Last are Varelze. And what are they?
The Pequeninos are not Varelze, neither is the Hive Queen.
But the Descolada is Varelze. An alien life form that's capable of destroying all of humanity.
Unless we can tame it.
Yet, which we cannot possibly communicate with. An alien species that we cannot live with. You're the one who said that in that case, war is unavoidable. If an alien species seems bent on destroying us, and we can't communicate with them, can't understand them, if there's no possibility of turning them away from their course peacefully, then we are justified in any action necessary to save ourselves, including the complete destruction of the other species.
Yes, said Valentine.
But what if we must destroy the Descolada, and yet we can't destroy the Descolada without also destroying every living Pequenino, the Hive Queen, and every human being on Lusitania? To Miro's surprise, Valentine's eyes were awash with tears. So, this is what you have become. Miro was confused. When did this conversation become a discussion of me? You've done all this thinking. You've seen all the possibilities for the future, good ones and bad ones alike. And yet the only one that you're willing to believe in, the imagined future that you seize upon as the foundation for all your moral judgments, is the only future in which everyone that you and I have ever loved and everything we've ever hoped for must be obliterated.
I didn't say I liked that future.
I didn't say you liked it either, said Valentine. I said that's the future you choose to prepare for. But I don't. I choose to live in a universe that has some hope in it. I choose to live in a universe where your mother and sister will find a way to contain the Descolada, a universe in which Starways Congress can be reformed or replaced, a universe in which there is neither the power nor the will to destroy an entire species.
What if you're wrong?
Then I'll still have plenty of time to despair before I die. But you, do you seek out every opportunity to despair? I can understand the impulse that might lead to that. Andrew tells me you are a handsome man. You still are, you know, and that losing the full use of your body has hurt you deeply. But other people have lost more than you have without getting such a black-hearted vision of the world.
This is your analysis of me? Asked Miro. We've known each other half an hour, and now you understand everything about me?
I know that this is the most depressing conversation I've ever had in my life.
And so you assume that it's because I am crippled. Well, let me tell you something, Valentine Wigan. I hope the same things you hope. I even hope that someday I'll get more of my body back again. If I didn't have hope, I'd be dead. The things I told you just now aren't because I despair. I said all that because these things are possible. And because they're possible, we have to think of them so they don't surprise us later. We have to think of them so that if the worst does come, we'll already know how to live in that universe.
Valentine seemed to be studying his face. He felt her gaze on him as an almost palpable thing, like a faint tickling under the skin inside his brain. Yes, she said.
Yes, what?
Yes, my husband and I will move over here and live on your ship. She got up from her seat and started toward the corridor leading back to the tube.
Why did you decide that?
Because it's too crowded on our ship, and because you are definitely worth talking to, and not just to get material for the essays I have to write.
Oh, so I passed your test.
Yes, you did, she said. Did I pass yours?
I wasn't testing you.
Like hell, she said. But in case you didn't notice, I'll tell you. I did pass, or you wouldn't have said to me all the things you said. She was gone. He could hear her shuffling down the corridor, and then the computer reported that she was passing through the tube between ships. He already missed her, because she was right. She had passed his test. She had listened to him the way no one else did. Without impatience, without finishing his sentences, without letting her gaze waver from his face. He had spoken to her, not with careful precision, but with great emotion. Much of the time his words must surely have been almost unintelligible, yet she had listened so carefully and well that she had understood all his arguments and never once asked him to repeat something. He could talk to this woman as naturally as he ever talked to anyone before his brain was injured. Yes, she was opinionated, headstrong, bossy, and quick to reach conclusions. But she could also listen to an opposing view, change her mind when she needed to. She could listen, and so he could speak. Perhaps with her he could still be Miro.